monthly podcast on the spoken word, episode number 86, March 2025. How playwrights hear their characters' voices. A conversation with James Still. Hello, Paul Meyer here. For the dialect coaches who are just getting started, and I know a lot of you follow this podcast, just wanted to let you know that I love passing on what I've learned in my 50 plus years in the business. It's so rewarding to help junior colleagues as they establish their own practices. I even offer a Paul Meyer Certificate of Proficiency in each of the 27 accents and dialects in my books. PaulMeyer.com/training is the place on my website to visit to learn more about this. Quiz time. Guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
Well, my coworker, sorry, I'm coming back. She began to run. And when she slid across the floor, it was funny. I'm sorry. It was funny. I think that was fun.
So, what was your guess? It was Ideas Bahamas 3. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then North America, then Bahamas. The subject, born and raised in Nassau, was contributed by senior editor Sarah Nichols. The speaker was 23 when Sarah recorded her in 2018. She identifies as Black Bahamian. Thanks again, Sarah. Now, this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend her formative years?
There was this other one. He often used to call me what I thought he was calling me, a daft aphid. And I knew aphids to be small green insects that lived on plants. I could never figure it out. But later as an adult, I did find out that what he was saying was, you're a daft Hapneyworth. We still had, no, we didn't have Hapneys then, or did we? I can't remember. It was well before we had decimal coins anyway. We did know pennies and shillings and things, but yeah. So, yeah, I built up, learned a lot of those kinds of phrases without actually knowing what on earth they meant, but they were very fascinating nonetheless.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you're not listening to me on PaulMeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode 86. You'll find lots of details there about my guest and other great audio and video links. You won't find these on any other podcast channel. So my guest this month is the multi-award-winning and Pulitzer-nominated playwright James Still. Welcome, James, to In a Manner of Speaking. This is episode 86 of In a Manner of Speaking. I can't believe we haven't had, until today, a playwright as a guest. Creating your character's manner of speaking. That's a huge part of a playwright's job, right?
Yeah, it is. It just, you know, there's all kinds of ways of looking at language. Language as action, language as internal world, language as a reflection of what's going on in the external world. Also language, and Shakespeare did this so brilliantly, right? It can tell us where we are. It can tell us the relationships just in a single line. Yeah. We'll know we're in the forest, or we'll know the king is dead. You know, something will happen. And so language, that's been a, you know, as a writer, has been a real joy to discover how I can explore a story through language.
So let's start with the big question. How do you find or construct or uncover the voices for your characters so that they jump off the page, fire up those imaginations, tell the story? Do you hear them in your head? What's your process as a writer?
Well, it depends on the project. I mean, sometimes a character can be very demanding and is almost like knocking at the door, you know, of my artistic soul relentlessly. And a character who believes they have something to say to me, and it's my job to decide whether or not they're a reliable narrator, because every character wants to believe the play is about them. And so I have to really sometimes, I can't always believe what a character tells me. Mm-hmm. So I have to spend time really working through that and figuring out in terms of story, as a writer, I came at this as an actor, right? And so in the beginning as a writer, I focused so much on character because that was what I knew. That's what I embodied as an actor. And after, you know, writing maybe five plays that had gotten attention, but they had not really left a mark and had not been produced widely or anything, I realized I needed to learn more, that I actually, character is something I can do with my eyes closed and in my sleep. Mm-hmm. It's really about structure for mm-hmm. me. And then structure, which includes language, how is language going to be part of structure? Mm-hmm. So in terms of my process, if it's a historical piece, which, you know, I'm inspired, I would say half of my work is inspired often by historical footnotes, people who might have been very famous, like Abraham Lincoln, but finding a moment in their lives that we may not know that much about. I always like to write about characters who we think we know, and then we realize maybe we didn't know at all. And so it's been also one of the reasons why it's been hard for me to ever hire a research assistant, is because I don't know what I'm looking for when mm-hmm. I'm doing the research. Mm-hmm. I am just looking and culling through letters and diaries, and I'm looking at, you know, what operas might have premiered that year. So what was happening in music around the world? What was happening, obviously, in politics around the world? What wars were being fought? What was the economic situation of wherever that play was set? So I cast a very wide net to begin with, and then I start to go more and more narrow as I go along. I think for me about language, it's really about trying to understand how people expressed themselves. And if it's a historical piece, and let's say it's 19th century or earlier, that means we're looking only at written materials. There's no recordings. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at diaries, and I'm looking at court records, and mm-hmm. I'm looking at newspapers, firsthand accounts, autobiographies. That, you know, those kinds of sources are what I do a deep dive into.
Trying to find the form and pressure of the age, as Hamlet has to say.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So apropos historical drama, we're going to read from your wonderful play, A New World. We're going to read a scene from that. Introduce the play to us, please, James.
I was reading through the Plymouth court records from the
1630s. Just in your idle moments, right?
Yes, you know, I mean, like, that's the kind of geek that I am. I had come across this idea. I wondered, I don't know, gosh, 20, 30 years ago, when we think about Thanksgiving and in the sort of the American mythology of that first Thanksgiving at Plymouth with the Native Americans and the pilgrims, as we sometimes call them. And as a queer person myself, I had this question of, well, I wonder if anyone was gay at that first gathering. That's a big question to ask and probably impossible to answer. And so I started to think about that, and I was like, well, is there a play there? And honestly, it kind of sounded like a Saturday Night Live sketch to me more than a play that I could commit to, you know, over 2, 3, 4 years of researching and writing. So I sort of put that away, but I had scribbled it on a napkin I'd written on an airplane, and I had it in a folder, you know, in my filing cabinet full of all those folders of things that I'll never write about, which I always thought I would always write about all of them. Back in 2016, I came across that again, and something opened up for me. It must have been the time we were living in. I went deeper into my research. That's what led me to the court records at Plymouth. And I found two paragraphs, which turned out to be the first court case against two young men who had had same-sex relations. Alarm bells went off for me, like, who were they? What was it? What happened? In my research, I had found out that just the year before, Plymouth had adapted its first justice code, and that same-sex relations was a capital crime. And if you were found guilty, you would be put to death. So I actually went to Plymouth. I spent time at the Living Museum there. I got a hold of scholars who were very steeped in this. They got very interested in this idea. No one seemed to have known about it. And so it was a deep immersion into that. So I wrote a play that's partly imagined, but also based on a lot of fact. I mean, I had the names of those two young men who were in their 20s, and I was able to follow one of them through his life. He would appear at certain points in the court records. The other one was an outsider, an itinerant worker. We might call him an immigrant now in 2025. He disappeared in history. There was no trace of him. That's what I imagined. I imagined where he came from, and I imagined he had been an actor in London in Shakespeare's time, and had come over, you know, like so many people, to try to figure out what to do with his life. The scene we're going to read is actually the first scene. And when I was looking at this again, that's sort of a couple of things I think listeners want to listen for is how information is embedded in the language. Where are we? Who are these people? What's the story that's about to happen? And it's pretty elegant when I think about how this story kicks off. Since listeners can't see this on the page, it's written in free verse.
That's a cue. That's a cue to the actor.
It is. It's like me whispering to the actors to pay attention to this. I'll be reading the Governor William Bradford, and you're going to be reading Thomas Prince, who's also a man of stature and status in the Plymouth colony.
Before we do that, you knew that I was going to be curious about your thoughts on the dialects. I've long wanted to coach, say, Crucible in what we now know to be the accurate dialect or accent of those early Proto-Americans. Did you consider the shape of the vowels, the sounds of the consonants?
I didn't as I was writing it, because that feels like much more of a production thing. You know,
yes.
William Bradford, the character I'll be reading, he left behind a lot of writing. So I did have access to how he expressed himself and syntax and things like that.
Yeah.
But I don't know how it sounded.
Yeah.
And that's something I would be eager to explore in a rehearsal situation.
Yeah. Just for fun, I'm going to read my part in a modified original pronunciation.
All right. Oh, this is going to be good. Good.
All right.
I'll be the much more American sounding William Bradford. and you can be the more appropriate sounding Thomas Prince.
Okay.
So shall we begin?
Yeah. So from A New World,
all right.
The first scene. All right, Mr. Bradford, kick us off.
Midbar. Be it any wonder that word appears in the Lord's book hundreds of times. Midbar, meaning wilderness, this howling wilderness, the promised land, our new Jerusalem, Plymouth, Midbar. Good morrow, Thomas.
Good morrow, Governor. How do you fare?
Strangely awake. The light of the full moon kept me up all night. I was still reading when sunrise took me by surprise.
The late night master studying his Hebrew again.
More the wide-eyed student. I seem unable to quench this hunger for reading the Bible as it was written to be read.
While I share not in the very passion, I marvel at your intention.
Learning Hebrew at my age, that be its own awful wilderness. But oh, to see my own eyes, those oracles of God in their native beauty. Us, Midbar.
Wilderness.
It is an ancient theme that never be tamed. Ours is this howling wilderness we call Plymouth. Tamer now than when we first came, but still part of God's mystery. How many mornings have I climbed this hill, wanting only to be closer to God? We are not alone up here. It be a cemetery, after all. But the dead are a quiet audience. For many years, I would walk down this hill, pass by every house in the colony with ease and order. There was beauty in knowing everyone by name and perchance some little truth about them. Every one of them. To see all of Plymouth now, I would need a higher hill. She spreads out like some greedy monster.
Some do call that progress, Governor.
Some, yes. You come, no doubt, in search of pleasing company, Thomas, and instead find mine.
Mistress Bradford said I should find you here on Burial Hill.
My dear wife knows me well. One day she and I will join this holy congregation of watchers, keeping watch and ward over Plymouth, even in our eternal rest.
May you praise God, you're right.
Thanks be to God. Now, what is it you wish from me, Thomas? Your serious presence begs for more than this man's musings on unslept philosophies.
That's great. Yeah. So I'm watching for what you've said about language as a revealer of place and time. And, and we're getting that in spades without any obvious exposition. Do you hate that word, exposition?
Well, I do if it's sadly revealed, for sure. And not all of my plays are quite as forward as this one is in that way. But again, I think this has to do with how language is used in the play. It's not, quote unquote, naturalistic. That heightened poetic quality, in a way, it gives me license as a writer to identify place and time and relationships with language. Some of my more contemporary plays, or should I say, plays that are set in more recent days, subtext is a language. Silence is a language in those plays.
Yes, yes.
Whereas in a play like this, it's very much language is spoken language, is expressed story.
Critiquing your own work or analyzing your own work here, in what other ways are the voices revealed?
Status is revealed in this. I mean, obviously, Thomas Prince is deferring to Bradford. As the scene goes on and the play goes on, Prince and others very much challenge Bradford as you know, somebody who is holding back progress. You know, that Bradford is wanting Plymouth to stay this sort of holy experiment, the whole reason that the Puritans fled Europe and came to the New America for quote-unquote religious freedom. What's happening 17 years after they've founded Plymouth is, of course, you have a whole generation now who were born in Plymouth, who are less educated, who are less focused on the religion that brought them here. And this is all very troubling for Bradford. So I think that's one of the things that language, there's a, you know, actually, if we can, I'd like to go to the very last. He's been through a lot at the end of this play. And he says, he's talking to Thomas Prince. Last night, I dreamt of the Mayflower. It'd be a dream that has mercifully left me alone for years. Always the same. The dream is of that long voyage where there be only water. Water for as long as one can see. Water, black, in that bottomless ocean. And the only sound, wood, creaking again and again, like wooden hands rubbing together in worry. That creaking wooden vessel that is never silent, never still. The wood grinding against itself, as that boat is blown farther and farther and farther off course toward another wilderness. And that's the end of the play.
Amazing.
And that, something about that, the way he's able to express, and that we hearken back to the Mayflower, which again is such an iconic image, but the way he personalizes that image, and also it turns into kind of almost a horror story. Yeah, yeah. Very much a metaphor. And this is an example, just really getting very personal here. I was in a very bad boat accident, actually in Kansas, when I was 19 years old. And I was on a boat that a tornado hit. It was capsized. A lot of people drowned. I was underwater. And the sound of that creaking wooden boat has haunted me my whole life. And people always ask me, have you ever written about that? And I never have.
Until now.
And that little monologue is the closest I've ever gotten.
Beautiful dialogue. Very easy to take that language on board as an actor. It sits in the mouth so very comfortably.
Yeah.
Frees us to shape the character with the words you've given us to speak.
Yes.
Moving forward a couple of centuries, how did you arrive at the very distinct manner of speaking for Abraham Lincoln in your wonderful The Heavens Are Hung in Black? I mean, so there's a,
well,
there's a mixture of folksiness and erudition.
Yes. This is an example of something that's very different from the play we just read from. The play we just read from, I had two paragraphs to go off of for a story to craft an entire play.
Now you have an embarrassment of riches, right?
Well, exactly. When I was commissioned by Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., which of course is the famous and infamous theater where Lincoln was assassinated, I knew what probably most people knew about Lincoln, very little. And probably most of it was mythology, not a lot of it was fact. And what I quickly discovered in my research is that he is the most written about person in the history of the world, except for Jesus. And I literally read and read and researched, and I went to Springfield, Illinois, and I, of course, spent a lot of time in D.C. researching Lincoln. And at some point after 3 years and Ford's Theater getting very nervous, I had to put my research aside and really start to craft this play, because there is so much information. And Lincoln wrote a lot of speeches. There's a lot of language that he left behind. Everyone seemed to want to cash in on their relationship with Lincoln. So lots of people wrote about their version of Lincoln, Lincoln mm-hmm. they knew. Ford's Theater, supposedly on the night that Lincoln was killed at the theater, Ford's Theater sat 1,700 people, and they were really crammed in because that theater seats about 700 people now in its modern use. So they were crammed in there. But honestly, if the number of people who say they were there that night were true, there would be thousands of people who were there. I had to start to quickly learn and discern for myself, like, what maybe is not true. Yeah, Lincoln was very daunting in some ways, but I knew some things about Lincoln. The things that jumped out about me and the way that his character emerged for me, and I would say simultaneously, the language emerged for me. There were, I guess, three sort of pillars. One was that he was an insomniac and that he felt very, very haunted by the deaths of the soldiers in the war. Remember, I was writing this not very long after weapons of mass destruction, and it proved not to be true in the U.S. And George Bush II was on record as saying he had no trouble sleeping at night. And then I was reading about Lincoln. He was haunted. And so that felt very interesting to me. Another thing was that he believed in the meaning of dreams. He would remember his dreams. He would try to figure out what they meant. And the third thing was he loved Shakespeare. Whether it's true or not, some people say he could recite entire plays by Shakespeare from beginning to end. But it was at Ford's Theater, and I knew there were going to be a lot of experts who were going to see this play. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a funny thing. In the previews for the play, I was very nervous because it was Washington, D.C. Ford's Theater was reopening after 2.5 years and a $50 million renovation. President Obama had just been inaugurated. And so there I was in Washington at this very heady moment. My play set in the Civil War, and we have elected our first Black president. There was so much going on. And at the first previews, I sat up in the balcony so I could watch the audience below as well. And I saw these historians and experts, and they had their notepads. I mean, they were ready to catch me in everything I got wrong. And what was so beautiful, Paul, is that about 10 minutes into the play, one at a time, I saw them putting their notebooks away mm-hmm. because it was very clear I had done my research. And you could disagree, with what I make of certain things in this play, but I don't think anyone can say I didn't do my work. I did the research.
It reminds me of my experiences at the opera when you've seen connoisseurs with the score open on their lap.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Are they going to miss that note? That is exactly right. Lincoln was a human being. He was a guy. He was full of flaws. He was living an extraordinary moment. And I wanted to get at, again, who was the Lincoln that we might not know? Not the Lincoln on Mount Rushmore, not the beautiful Lincoln Memorial Lincoln, but who was that human being? And that is why in the very first scene in the play opens, his back is to the audience. He's looking out his window in his office in the White House. And he's looking at the Washington Memorial, which is about a third finished because they ran out of money. And so it's this stump, which is a great metaphor as well, right? And he's looking out there. And when he turns and faces the audience the first time, he is sobbing. And so our first image of Lincoln is a man who's weeping. His 9-year-old son has died not long before that. The war is not going well. This is in 1862, I believe, is when the play is set. So things are not looking good. And I wanted right away to put the audience on notice. This is not going to be a museum piece.
Mm-hmm.
getting to the scene we're going to read from, which is when Lincoln stumbles into a theater to get out of a rainstorm and stumbles in on a rehearsal for Henry V. The actor in this company is Edwin Booth, who, of course, is the brother to John Wilkes Booth, who would kill Lincoln a few years later. I will say this scene, it's kind of foolproof. I will say with audiences, it is one of the most delightful scenes. It's something about seeing Lincoln sort of as one of these actors and sort of playing a naivete, which turns out to be he knows much more than he's letting on.
I listened to one of the few recordings we have of Edwin Booth and a very, very British accent.
Which is a nice contrast when you think about it to Lincoln, which was, you know, he was
folksy, in
Indiana, Kentucky, yeah. Illinois, and very much known for that and known for his very folksy humor, which the play also relies on because the play is, you know, there's a lot of sorrow and grief in this play. And so the humor became very important. And, you know, at one point, Lincoln is supposed to say, "I laugh so as not to weep." It was a weapon for him, humor. And he used it also to disarm people. It's almost like a sleight of hand for Lincoln. So that was another way, that was another clue for me about language and how Lincoln used language. He also didn't mind coming across as a country bumpkin because he would use that to his advantage.
Yeah.
Because he was almost always the smartest person in the room, but he never acted that way. And that, again, was a clue to language.
Yeah. A diversionary tactic.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Exactly.
All right, Mr. Lincoln, let's hear you.
A thousand pardons for interrupting. Booth, isn't it?
Edwin, yes. Edwin Booth, sir.
I thought it was you. I often watch plays with my eyes closed, so it's the voice I recognized first.
Sir, Mr. President.
Just call me Lincoln and we'll get along fine. Quite a storm out there. I was without umbrella. The door was open. Well, so sorry to have troubled you then.
No, stay, please. Sir, we were just finishing a rehearsal. You're welcome to stay. Wait the rain out?
Never occurred to me that you people actually rehearsed. I've never seen one. A rehearsal. Henry V, yes?
Yes, Mr. President.
Call me Lincoln.
Of course, Mr. President. You know Shakespeare?
Oh, indeed. A fellow back in New Salem introduced me. When the men there got drunk, they do the usual tussle and brawl. But when old Kelso got drunk, he'd astonish us all with copious quotations from our divine William. I often found Shakespeare to be just about the best company I could find. I still can't believe you actually rehearsed the thing. You're from a family of actors, isn't that so?
Yes, the family business. My brother plays more of the romantics, and I'm stuck with the likes of Iago, Lear, Shylock, Hamlet, Henry. All the flawed and tragic heroes.
And you actually rehearse all of them? The same thing over and over again?
Yes.
Which one have you played the most?
I suppose I've played Hamlet hundreds of times.
And you never tire of him?
Oh, no.
Then he's a much more interesting character than the President of the United States. That's a role you wouldn't want to play hundreds of times.
It probably would depend on which president I was playing.
Yes, indeed. It probably would. Are you a man of politics, Mr. Booth?
I'm ashamed to admit it, sir, but the truth is I've never voted.
Not even once?
I'm sorry. No.
Don't worry. Most of my in-laws didn't vote for me either. So this is what it looks like from up here. To be or not to be, that is the question. Original thinkers have a way of making the rest of us seem quite ordinary.
Yes, Shakespeare was a great writer.
Oh, he was a genius.
But not really an original thinker.
No.
If he were an original thinker, I don't believe his work could continue to please so many people. There's not one original thought in Hamlet's soliloquy. To be or not to be, That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them? Those are the thoughts and words which would occur to any able man under the same circumstances, uttered by the right actor who rises to the sublime solemnity of the moment. He makes those thoughts seem born anew.
I'm afraid to loudly confess this to an actor, but it matters not to me whether Shakespeare be well or ill acted. With him, the thought is what matters most.
Shakespeare wrote about men whose lives require great thoughts in order to survive.
So you agree it's Shakespeare's thoughts that matter most?
No, his character thoughts matter most. Secondary is the structure, the logic of movement, the clarity of arrangement which leads to persuasion. And last of all comes rhetoric, the satisfying choice of words, the rhythm of the sentence, the harmony of the sounds themselves spoken, all the exquisite and graceful details, which when spoken by the actor can alone ensure perfection.
I'm sure you're right, Mr. Booth, but in the end, he was still the son of a Stratford butcher. I think I like Shakespeare because he was able to keep so many deaths off stage.
Mr. Lincoln. Yeah. Stopping there? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Great. That's a remarkable.
Yeah, I think, as the scene turns, what happens, of course, the example at the end of the scene where me, the writer, Lincoln, and Shakespeare sort of merge because Lincoln finds, and the audience, we find deep meaning in what the soldier Will says to Henry in the passage that Lincoln then quotes. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing is, in this scene is you've seen Lincoln be very playful and very deferred to Edwin Booth and, pretended as though, I'm just an audience member. I don't know anything. And then when he begins that speech from Henry V, but if the cause be not good, the king himself have a heavy reckoning to make. It takes this very dark turn. It's not performative at all. It is a prayer. It is, a cry in the dark. It is his inner thoughts. Because at the end of that speech, he says, I am afeard there are few die well that die in a battle. For how can they charitably dispose of anything when blood is their argument? Now, if these men do not die well, it will be a black matter for the king that led them to it. And so again, Lincoln finding new meaning in this speech from Shakespeare.
Moving up to the present day, let's talk about your intriguing play, Miranda, set in Yemen in 2014. Such a different use of language. Tell us about it.
Just looking at what's on the page, because your listeners can't see that, when we move from scene to scene, there's actually an arrow that's on the page that's sort of, I'm trying to communicate to designers, to actors, to technicians, a kind of breathlessness. My character, Miranda, she has been haunted by the ghost of bin Laden. This scene that I'm going to read is, it's in the middle of the night, and she's talking to her mother on the phone. Miranda is talking to her about this dream that she's had.
Read it to us.
I was in the woods behind Jack's house. I was hunting with that old guy who lived on the next farm over. God. So in my dream, I'm going to shoot my first buck, which is weird because, growing up, I never touched a gun. But in this dream, in my dream, I want to kill. And not like a sport. I just want to know that I can kill something. It's so weird, that feeling. And then I see something move behind a maple. First, it's just a shadow. So I raise the gun. I want to be ready. I look through the sight and I wait. Then the shadow turns into a deer, a buck. He turns his head and looks right at me. But then I see the shadow isn't a deer. It's a man. I know who he is. He knows I know who he is. And we just stare at each other. His eyes are sad and black, just like a deer. His face is long, his beard streaked with gray. He's holding a bottle of black hair dye, and he has a handkerchief pinned to his sleeve. It's my handkerchief. I lower the gun and whisper like he's right next to me, like you can hear it. I want to kill you. And he doesn't flinch, just says, no. Say it in the language of Allah. And I do. Ashti uktuk, ashti arak mayet. And he says, analastu man ana. I am not what I am. Suddenly, he's a deer again, disappearing into the woods, a shadow on fire, a stream of hair dye trailing after him like black blood. Did I lose you, Mom? Are you asleep? You are, it's okay. I wish I were asleep too. I wish a lot of things, but it's already light here. I should get up while it's still cool out. I know I haven't said this in a long time, but I miss you. Things here are... Did you know Bin Laden's father was from Yemen? Yeah. Good night, Mom. And whoever else is there listening, fucking amateurs.
Such different language, yes. Mm-hmm. Over these three plays set in different centuries, you've demonstrated an enormous range of your command of language, James.
Thank you. I was thinking about this, Paul. I hadn't written a play that was before the 20th century until about 2005. I adapted Booth Tarkington's 1898 novel, A Gentleman from Indiana. And it was set in the early 1890s in a small town in Indiana. Because it was a novel, it was very story-driven. But the language was, you know, was a little heightened, but it was Midwestern and it still felt familiar. But I will tell you, there was something about, I remember Tech, the first time I saw the actors, especially the women in the clothes. And when I saw that silhouette, I burst out crying, for one thing. And the other thing was, I understood why they spoke the way they did. There was something about the clothes they were wearing was a hint about how they used language.
How they presented themselves to the world, right?
Yes. Yes. Posture, containment, restraint. And then how, you know, expressing yourself, how language became even more important because your body language was restricted. And so language then, you know, just became the words you chose.
Yes. Expressive within confinement somehow.
Yes. Yeah. Wanting to break out of the cage that was, in some cases, the clothes they were wearing. So I went back to that, you know, again, when you go back to Lincoln, Mary Lincoln, which then I would later write a play about Mary Lincoln and the extraordinary clothes that women were wearing in the Victorian era in the United States. And then going back to Plymouth, the very austere clothing that they would wear and the silhouette was a very different silhouette in terms of their rituals and yeah. values.
You have to wear
the... So it's just interesting how all that connects, right? How silhouette, clothing, language, action, it is all connected. And I don't think I knew that as a writer at all.
We wear our clothes the same way we wear our language. We are acting within a paradigm, a worldview, a cosmology. Mm-hmm. It's all there, isn't it? Wherever you look,
yeah.
you see that world and it's revealed in a
yeah.
homogenous way.
When someone rebels against that containment or whatever, how again sort of stripping away those clothes is a metaphor as well. You know, that's why I think, you know, like there's a scene in the first play we read from mine in A New World where the two young boys, where they take off their clothes. And that was just, again, that sort of stripping away to be as free as possible in a place where they had no freedom. They were both of very low status and they were engaged in what would become a capital crime. And so there was something about, you know, ripping off your clothes was the closest thing to freedom that they could get.
And how did the language echo that physical freedom, would you say?
Well, because it became more intimate. The language became more intimate. You know, it became more vulnerable, certainly sexually charged. That was a part of it, being full of emotion and finding ways to express that. The way I think, you know, in 2025, if we're lucky, we can find that. You know, if you find yourself falling in love or having a crush, our language changes. You know, the way we express ourselves, our temperature literally changes. And so again, how is even our body heat connected to how we express ourselves? You know, so there's all kinds of ways that I ask myself questions about how a character would express themselves, from the clothes they're wearing to the body temperature to the relationship they're in to, you know, just the way they all
move,
of those things.
The way they move their body through space.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Speaking of language, I'm getting ready to go direct The Glass Menagerie at Indiana
Master,
Repertory Theater.
Tennessee Williams.
There we go. God. And
the world had to learn how to listen to Tennessee Williams in the same way as we had to learn how to listen to Beckett. Waiting for Godot. I remember my mother coming back from the theater watching Waiting for Godot back in, what, the early 50s?
50s, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she had been among a very few people who stood, booed, and walked out.
She had not
learned to hear. And I think perhaps the actors had not yet learned to hear.
You know, the great story about that play, of course, is that it was a huge failure when it came to New York in the 50s. Yeah. The way it found its way to our canon was a performance done at a prison in San Francisco. And those prisoners understood Waiting for Godot. They went crazy for it. And that lit a fire under that play and the reporting on that play, and it made its way back.
It's an invitation to an actor, isn't it?
It is. I use that word invitation a lot, and I just would want to say that again, that I feel like language in my plays, they're always an invitation to the actor and to the artists who are collaborating on the play. Yeah. What's the invitation? And as a director, when I start rehearsal for Glass Menagerie this week, I'll be saying the same thing to the actors. What's the invitation that Tennessee Williams, the hand that he's holding out to us, and what's the hand we're holding out to the audience? And how is language a part of that?
Yes. Very briefly, where can my listeners catch your work?
Well, I have a new play called Everybody's Favorite Mothers, which is set in the early 1970s. I don't think I've ever written a play in the 1970s. And it is about the mother, a woman named Jean Manford, again, a historic character, who turned out to be the first parent who marched in the gay pride parade with her gay son. And she and her husband went on to found PFLAG, which is now a very well-known organization that supports family and friends of folks who are gay. It is a beautiful theatrical celebration. Marge Simpson, Mrs. Cratchit, Maria von Trapp, the Virgin Mary are all characters in that play as well. So it will tell you a little bit about the theatrical imagination of that play. And that play is going to be happening, God willing, at theaters around the country. And then I'm writing two new plays, one for American Blues Theater in Chicago, a play called Haunt Me, which I'm writing for the wonderful actor Mary Beth Fisher, which is sort of a horror thriller AI play.
Yes.
And then the other play is I'm writing a commissioned play for Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts, about the late Senator Paul Tsongas, who ran for president in 1992 as sort of the first out cancer survivor.
Well, good luck with all of those projects. I hope my listeners will take their opportunity to catch one of those productions near you. Thanks for being with me today, James.
Thank you, Paul.
And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, and my guest, James Still. For more information about him and his work, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar, and click episode number 86. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and Instagram, and me on X or Twitter at @DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions. paul@paulmeyer.com. See you next month on In a Manner of Speaking.